After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
Welcome to the Be Here Now guest podcast. This series features a collection of teachings and conversations centered around mindfulness, spiritual growth, and living a life in balance. Each week, our diverse network of guest teachers and hosts offer up wisdom and practices from a different spiritual path and perspective. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/donate.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Ram Dass Fellowship. I am not Jackie Dobrinska. I'm Raghu Marcus. And Jackie is having to take a little time to heal up. And so here I am and happy to be here with, it's always fun to be with Satsang. So I feel like I've got a nice opportunity to hang out with Spring Washam and all of you. Because as Thich Nhat Hanh said, the next Buddha is the Sangha or Satsang. So here we are. And I would say that the first thing that I would like to do is maybe just get settled here, take a few breaths in and do what Ram Dass has recommended in the latter years of his life so strongly, which is to move from the eye up in the head that is the big judger and storyteller into the center of one's chest, into the loving awareness spot, which is called by many different names. And all we got to do, it's a very simple process. It's taking a breath in to the center of our being, and a breath out. And as you do it, you feel your perspective moving from your head and everything we've been doing all day long and all of the different identities that we have and roles, and let it out. So another breath in. And out goes all of the unfortunate little schmooze that Ram Dass used to talk about that we get grasping at, attachments and so on. And one last breath. And we can feel ourselves hopefully a little bit more firmly ensconced in that spiritual heart. That's kind of the, I like that description of it. There's many names for it. So again, welcome, and I'm happy to be here with Spring. And Spring is a meditation teacher, author, visionary leader, and she does these wonderful trips into South America. And I have your bio here, Spring, and nobody's talking about the great shamanistic work that you do and visionary work, and that is alongside of really a quote-unquote practical meditation practice. You know, you bringing mindfulness-based healing practices to diverse communities is terrific work that Spring does. And teaches at East Bay Meditation Center. I think you still do in downtown Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And so welcome. And Spring's going to talk about wisdom, compassion, strength, and courage. Any one of those things would take about a week's retreat, but let's see what happens here. But welcome, Spring, to the Ram Dass Fellowship.
Thank you. And I always love this fellowship. There's a lot of sweetness here, a lot of kindness. And I really appreciate the heart and I appreciate the devotion. And I appreciate Ram Dass as our great ancestor now. Mm. I was thinking about him as an ancestor, you know, how he's still alive. He's still floating around. And I really, there's a lot of strength we can draw from that, from his words, the writing. You know more than anybody. You're sort of the caretaker of all of the files.
Many, one of the many, many,
the
many.
The archives of the wisdom teachings. Well, that's a good thing, you know. And as I think about this topic of strength, courage, and wisdom, I think about how much our ancestors do mean to us. And, you know, when we think about shamanism, and people might have thought I had a different topic, but I want to talk about the strength that we draw from our family tree, where we come from, who we are, all of those things matter. You know, we are a product of our great, 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 great grandmothers and our great, 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 great grandfathers. You know, we are who we are because of them. And I think it's really a beautiful exploration to really think about ourselves in a living lineage. Just like Ram Dass has a living lineage, you know, through his guru, and the Tibetan traditions are living lineages. I think there's something really powerful about recognizing ourselves in a lineage, right? As someone who carries that lineage forward. And I know for me, really connecting with that in the last few years has been heartbreaking and empowering. You're not going to escape the sadness and the pain of the lineage. there's always the ancestors that seem to ruin everything. But then there's always these ancestors that build everything back up, right? And who are you going to be in your living lineage? What are you going to leave behind? What are people going to say in your family tree about you? You know, it's really important to think about that. The seven generations that come after us, the next generation. I've been thinking about that a lot as all of us are moving in different times, but we're moving into elderhood, not old, but elder is an archetype, right? An archetypal role of someone who carries wisdom, right? A wise elder, not just a grumpy old stuck elder. We don't really need that. We need like the wisdom, the courageous elders. I think our young generation is crying out for that. And I think in some ways, Ram Dass really represents that. You know, over to his last breath, he had this place of being the wise elder. You know, I would run into people all the time, young people, and they'd just be getting his book, Be Here Now. And they'd be so excited, like it was did you ever hear about this book? I was like, this is so great. Yes. You know, he's the wise elder for you, you know? And I just love that, you know, that, this can go on and on. So I invite our community tonight, our fellowship, our friends, to where do you see yourself? How can we learn to draw strength from our ancestors, who we are, where we come from, the land we were born on? You know, this means a lot. This is a part of our identity on the relative level. Of course, on the absolute level, we're just stars, right? We know that. We're light. We're cosmic. But on the relative level, here and now, this does mean something, right? This does mean something. And as we think about ancestors and who we call on in our prayers, even the gurus are what? They're just our ancestors now. If you really think about it, all the greats, Ramana Maharshi, Bhagavan, Nityananda, all of them, Yogananda, now Ram Dass. Right? There are ancestors and they're still alive. They're on our altars. We're talking to them. And the same way you talk to them is the same way you can talk to your own ancestors that have passed on. And there's a kind of power that we can draw on, a strength, especially to those ancestors that had a lot of fortitude, a lot of wisdom. And that might take some looking in your family tree. It might take you to go back and see what was my great-great-grandmother like? Where was she born? What was her life like? Great-grandfather, where was he from? Where did he grow up? Right? These are energies that are connected to us, and we can understand ourselves deeper, actually, through this. In the West, we're not taught that we live in lineages. We're taught of individuals alone, walk this path as a lone soldier, right? Fight it out by yourself. You came here alone. Nothing matters. You disappeared. And you go forth by yourself, you know? And I think that that's, you know, it's not accurate. I'll just say it's inaccurate, for lack of a better word. And I think of Maya Angelou, the great writer and poet. She used to say, I come as one, but I stand as 10,000, meaning 10,000 ancestors, right? And you see this a lot in the African-American world. I feel the ancestors are very alive, Native American too, right? Ancestors are right there. But somehow, I think sometimes in the West, we have a blindness to that and we miss out on the connection and the wisdom that can come through and the power. I mean, Maya Angelou said, I stand with 10,000, meaning those 10,000 were somehow supporting her, right? They were standing with her, behind her, pushing her. And I just think there's something really beautiful about that, as I feel like all these gurus and teachers and lamas, all those that have passed on, they're still standing with us. Right. And we know that we feel it. You don't have to tell me how much we all feel our teachers who have passed on that are still alive. Right. And they're still downloading. So I wanted to think about that a little bit with the audience tonight, as thinking about your own ancestors and how you relate to the idea that you are in a living lineage and you are part of that lineage. And the work that you do, the spiritual work that you do, can affect that lineage, right? You can heal that line. It's like a family tree, right? That has like, that needs to be trimmed up, or it's growing out of control, or it's a little bit sick. You can water it. You can trim it. You can take care of it, and you can send nutrients up into the tree. It's very, very powerful to think about our lives in that context. We all just nature. Mm. Yeah, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I just want to remind people, because I forgot, that you can write in a question for Spring in the chat, and we will try our best to get as many into answering as many as possible. So I want everybody to know that. And, you know, in about 15 minutes or whenever spring feels like it, we can go there. But if something pops up, like we're talking about ancestors right now, and everything you said is very provocative for people, because mm-hmm. we don't have that tradition, which is the wisdom tradition of indigenous people mm-hmm. around our ancestors. They do in India, and I've experienced it there with our family over there. But I have worked with a couple of different shaman who absolutely have helped me enormously to understand the process that you just described.
Yes, thank you. And of course, I love questions. Actually, that's the best way that I teach, is in a Q&A kind of live interactive standpoint. So I love that. And also, you know, we are all on this healing journey together. And learning about your ancestors also can give you a lot more compassion for yourself, your habits, the way that you operate, the belief systems that you have, sort of the programming that you have. Sometimes we feel frustrated that we're not farther along in our path, and we feel, why is my heart still closed? Or why do I have these fears? Or why do I respond in these certain ways? A lot of this, if you go in your family, you'll see, my father's like that. My grandfather's like that. My mother's like that, right? And this is really important. This can give us a lot more compassion for ourselves. Like, everything is passed down. And this is like the shamanic work where, you know, I've seen so many powerful stories. Working in Peru, I remember I had this one guest that came down, and she was Chinese, but grew up in London and had moved to the United States. And she had this terrible problem with her feet, even though she was beautiful and healthy, this unbearable pain in her feet. And then when she did some family research, her grandmother was the last one in her family to be foot bound, like where they binded their feet. And here she was in this day and age, unbearable pain. And I said, well, let's just work on it and work on it and work on it. But once she understood that, it was like, oh, okay, this is my work. So a lot of times what we're doing is this overwhelming sense of, you know, baggage sometimes that we have, it's not just ours. You know, this is, we're going back and back and back. And the more that we can purify what's arising through awareness, through the heart, finding our courage to know the truth, to be with the truth, truth of the moment, or the truth of whatever's happened around us in our families. But we've got to be willing to take the blinders off and see that we're much more interconnected. This is not, we're not lone individuals. We're born, you know, into a community. And like you said, you read that Thich Nhat Hanh poem, or that his saying where, you know, the next Buddha is the community. And it's away from the individual self into the sense of we're all one here, right? And we're all connected in multitude of ways. I mean, who knows how vast this really goes. According to the Tibetans, everyone on the planet has been your mama, okay? So there you go. Everybody's been your father, right? That's really profound. We can't even really, we don't have the capacity to take that in, you know? But that doesn't mean it's not accurate, right? It doesn't mean that's not, that might be a real, real deep truth. But what we can do is start to look at ourselves in a living lineage. Where are my people? Where is my lineage? Are they, is there wisdom? Is there compassion? And then we can bring forth that out of ourselves, right? We can heal by just our consciousness. And that's what I'm doing, a lot of the work I'm doing. So when I think about courage and I think about strength, I think about both of my lineages are pretty broken. right? In the last few years, just by all of the traumas and dramas and pain, but somehow like you step into that and you use it. You use them. You use the suffering to open something. You know, suffering can be very powerful if we open our heart to it. And I say this with real experience. I'm not just giving you a line out of a book. I'm giving you this from my heart, my gut, is that the difficulties, even family or health or societal, these are mirrors, you know, and we can grow if we open to them. We can learn by opening to them. We can see reality in a different way, and we can see the kind of person we don't want to be and how much our real heart is needed in the world, you know? And this is where real strength comes from. You know, it comes from the willingness to be with what feels unbearable, right? To open to it. The Buddha, I always think of the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, and he's all these, you know, years sitting there, and all these things are coming up in the mind stream. How could they not, right? Everything's there. And, you know, his message to the world was, yes, there's madness. It's crazy. How do you heal it? Open to it. Which is so counter. It's so counter to what we think about, right? When things are hard, we don't open to it. He's saying, you want to liberate it? Surrender and just open to it, right? This is not the Western way. The Western way is fight it first, suppress it, medicate it, ignore it, deny it. And then when it's right about to kill you, I'll open to it. We can go a long way.
Yeah. There's a multitude of spiritual bypass around suffering, for sure.
Oh, and I mean, I have compassion for all of them. They're just strategies.
Yeah.
They're strategies.
Oh, that's so great. I'll just tell you, because it just occurs when you just started talking about courage. Okay, so there's actually a famous story, and I'm sure people that are with us tonight may have heard it, but it's worth repeating one of those stories. It's from Krishna Das, and he was with Neem Karoli Baba and out of station. He was in Mumbai in a hotel room of all things, and he came, so he got together there. And they were with one Indian devotee who was doing the translating. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, Maharaji said, courage is everything. So the Indian devotee said, no, this is bhakti, devotional. We're bhaktas. And whatever comes just comes through the guru. And it's, you know, the traditional interpretation of bhakti yoga, basically. And to Maharaji, no, what do you mean? It's, you know, courage, because it implies developing something that you can have a part in, right? And then Maharaji he looked at Krishnadas and he went like this. Courage is a very important thing. He reiterated again. For the rest of his life, Krishnadas, whenever things have gotten, you know, where we're talking about suffering and gotten to a place where you can turn one way or the other, either fight it or, as you said, surrender and be in it and allow it to be, that whole moment would come to him and he'd be able to have so much support to navigate. So courage, very important, right?
Very important. I don't think anyone can survive on the path without it, because you might experience a lot of bhakti, but then you might not. And then what do you do? And you got to have your courage to deal with that. You got to have a certain fortitude to look at life honestly, to see all the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. Yeah, it takes heart. it takes courage to get in a relationship where it's unknown and unchartered, you know, here today, gone tomorrow. It takes courage to deal with this reality that's impermanent and always changing. You know, it takes a lot of heart. And I think also of Harriet Tubman, where I'm writing a book about Harriet Tubman right now, very spiritual book. It's like a channeled book. It's very mystical. And she's writing from being a very evolved being, right? That came down like a angel that came, bodhisattva, that came down to. And I don't know a more courageous human being, spirit being than Harriet Tubman. I mean, it's pretty mind blowing. I mean, that was kind of the core superpower. But it came from just having an open heart too, right? And the willingness to be with fear, the willingness to feel it and be with it.
I think the open heart is so absolutely crucial. And how easy is it for us to feel so oppressed that we can't allow things to be? And what any teacher would say to somebody who had the question, well, how do I open my heart when things are really rough? And it goes beyond what I think my capacity is to actually let go in the moment. And there's only one answer, practice. That is the element that none of us like, because there is a discipline involved, and it can't be the I need to discipline. It has to come from a different place, which usually happens when, you know, things get really rough. And then you have to spend the time, whichever way, if it isn't meditation, certainly, as you mentioned before, mindfulness and awareness to see who we are not and allow that to change. But sitting somewhere for a few minutes in contemplation, meditation, chanting, whatever it may be, so that you are sitting with that being inside ourselves that is not caught the way that we are when we allow our thoughts to take over.
And another way to practice too, if people want to be more interactive, is at the beginning of your day, make every person you meet your heart practice. From the bus driver, and you just say, hi, you emanate love. You practice sharing your love. I've had so much magic with that. I mean, this love field just takes you in adventures and gifts, and it just becomes, the day becomes so much more fun. Because you're engaged in this heart level, you can start to practice that more and more. Go on a walk and have that mindset. I'm just going to be love. And the more we practice it, like anything, what you practice grows.
Practice makes perfect.
It can take a long time, but we're going to get there.
It's an ongoing journey, for sure, for decades. When you were talking about suffering, we had talked about this before we got on, and I said, when you get the kind of suffering that really has you up against the wall, Ram Dass becomes a good example of how one can look out and move their perspective over just a few feet can make a huge difference in how this suffering gets transformed. And Fierce Grace, we talked about that film. I don't know if any of you out there have not seen that particular film with Ram Dass about his stroke. It's well worth watching. But the reality is, we're not at the question. Well, we're at the Q&A part already. I'm going to start it, okay, Spring? What is a efficacious way, shall we say, to move one's perspective out of that belief in the thinking mind, the story, and the perspective that we were ingrained into as a child with parents. As soon as you get your name, okay, I'm a something now and I'm a somebody, and it goes on from there. How to move that perspective over a little bit so that it is no longer the judge and jury, just that kind of simple thing.
Yes, yes. And the questions are always about moving more into care. How do I care about this life? What does compassion look like? What is compassion? I get that question all the time. I don't know what it is. Just means care. I care about the pain in my body and my heart. I care about the pain around me, and I want to reduce it in some way. I would like to alleviate it. We can start there. The thought of what can I do to maybe lessen my own and then those around. You know, we can start very basic. You know, it doesn't have to be some grand, you don't have to be the Dalai Lama right now. Just be you. It's very hard for any of us to be the Dalai Lama, okay?
We want to be the Dalai Lama.
We want to be the Dalai Lama, but Dalai Lama has many lifetimes as Dalai Lama.
Yeah, that's true.
We have many lifetimes with ourselves, you know, and these kind of...
But you know what he said? Did you see? I mean, I saw, yeah, I've heard him say this many times before. It was Mother's Day yesterday, and so he made some, they put up either comments he made or at some other point about his mother. He said, my mother was so compassionate. I was the youngest child, and he said, she would put me on her shoulders and went out working and so on, and I had one hand on each ear, and I'd pull in one direction to the direction I wanted to go. And then when she wouldn't do it, I'd cry and I'd stomp and everything. And she only loved me. He said, whatever you see of me, whatever compassion I have now is from my mother. And he's said it other times. That is what is going to save humanity, is that mothers evincing this kind of love and compassion, and then that child growing into a being that's going to really contribute, serve. Basically, which is what you just said about, here's how to shift the perspective. Start, I'm going to put it in very simple, really simple terms. Start thinking about others other than yourself all the time.
Yes.
That'll switch your perspective out of this me.
Yeah, and it's not and I love that story, by the way. He wrote a book about his mother that I just wept about. It was so devotional. And I had that story where he would all day long he'd be grabbing her ears trying to and that's what mothers do. God bless them. You know, the good mamas out there who's trying to raise their children with love and compassion. And still, if you didn't get raised like that, there's hope. You know, we can do this. There's change that happens through awareness, through practice, and through just practicing, you know, through practicing kindness. Kindness is my practice every time I leave my house. You know, even when I get impatient, I'm like, okay, kindness, okay. And it just makes everything go so much better. Even when I'm not getting what I want, you know, like someone saying, no, we can't really do that. It's like, okay, okay, kindness anyway. you know, it's just, that's okay. But a lot of times things do go well. You know, people respond and it's to know that everyone right now, I guess a message to the whole fellowship is that everyone in this moment in time is desperate for it. And if it's someone who's working at a restaurant or giving you coffee, like to see them, to recognize them, you have no idea what one or two kind words can do for someone. Right. We minimize the impact of our heart, too.
Yeah.
Right. We don't see like, oh, well, why? No, they're just doing this thing. I'll ignore them. But if we turn to the person and we say, thank you. I appreciate you. Wow. You cleaned this whole space, or this happened, or something happened around that, it can really it can really change someone's life in that moment and deeply nourish them, right? So just don't underestimate your own powerful heart.
Mm. Very true.
Yeah, very.
Here's a question. It's very delicate when one speaks of one of the Eightfold Path being right effort, and we talk about practice a lot. We mm-hmm. all do in all of these formats. And it can get very delicate when one is coming from, let's say, not quite the open heart space around practice. And there's, I should do it. Mm-hmm. It's not, it is here and I am in it, do it. It's there's a big difference between the perspective. So back to perspective. Mm-hmm. What is the right perspective to get into with in terms of right effort and practice?
Well, you know, what's interesting is the Eightfold Path, I started translating right as wise. Mm. What is the wise effort, yeah. right? What is
less polarizing.
Yeah, right gets in the wrong and then yeah, I'm bad yeah, and yeah. then, you know, yeah. and then we feel like there's a dictator over us. And then, you know, we can make a monster out of anything, even yeah. our spiritual Amazing. Practice. And that's our habit. I understand that. You know, I think with practice, you have to be gentle. You know, there's times where we have a lot of motivation and we get on a spurt. You know, it's like a marathon we're going. But then the marathon ends, right? You get to the 22nd mile and then you're like, well, I'm tired. And then it's in that, you know, that midpoint before you hit another big stride. How do we stay motivated? Mm. And I think it's different for all of us. It's define your deeper intention. Why do I want to practice? Why am I doing this? We can lose track of that because we just get in the discipline. I'm supposed to sit here. I'm supposed to do this. And I really think practicing in that way isn't really that helpful. I've seen strivers on, I used to teach long retreats. I'll never forget. I taught this 6-week retreat at Insight Meditation Society. And there was this group of young guys and they were just the strivers and they were killing themselves thinking they were so miserable and so restless and they wanted to leave and they were crying and then they, I will not leave. And I said, honey, just let go. Just be in your heart. What are you trying to get? What is this about? You're making yourself insane. It was like competitive meditation.
Yeah, that's great.
You know,
that's America.
It was, I just would, and they would just be weeping, you know, when they would be in an interview with me. And I would just say, just stop all of this and just do compassion practice because compassion, love will know the effort needed in any situation. You know, and it'll apply the effort at the right moment. You know, yes, it's good to practice, but be careful of the mind state. You know, even if we're tired and we know it's a good thing, if you're doing it out of this like brutality, just stop for a moment. Because you're just kind of conditioning that. I actually don't think it's that helpful, you know, but if we can kind of, okay, develop a little bhakti, turn on the music, feel our energy, pray to the gurus, sing. There are other ways to get the mind ready, you know, and I'm a big believer in preparation for long periods of meditation. Oh. Like I don't just hang up the phone, have a terrible conversation, go, I'm going to meditate and then sit down and think of, could be good sometimes, but that's not going to... The sustaining is the love and the bhakti and the compassion. Mm. It's not the, you know, drill sergeant.
Yeah.
Well, we always rebel against them. So,
I had a drill sergeant for a father and I am like still listening to the drill sergeant.
Yeah,
I'm laughing a little bit more at it than I ever used to. So, you know, it's
yeah, it's true. You grew up with a drill sergeant, Raghu?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, then it's hard to get it.
Actually, sorry, Dad.
Well, it's good, but then then we have to be aware that that voice of how you do things, right, and how compassion is not the path. Tyrants hate compassion, right? So therefore, that's something, you know, that's something that inside ourselves that we might approach situations at different times. And all of us have the tyrant. All of us. All of us have the tyrant. We're both. We're the tyrant. We're the devotee. We're the lover. We're the murderers. We're, you know, we're the dance.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Well, you know, this is a non sequitur. It had nothing to do with anything, but I was saved because I'm thinking about my father now.
Yeah.
He came to India to visit my brother and I, thinking that would be a good thing to do after he found out he wasn't coming to save us. He was actually coming there to see what in the hell is going on, these people. My son's there with this guru, what the hell? So he came over, and what happened subsequently when he first met Maharaji was, Maharaji turned to me and went, "Did you give him the medicine?" I said, "Yeah, he had a cold. I gave him some aspirin." He said, "No, the yogi medicine Ram Dass gave me." I went, "Acid?" And my father went, "LSD?" And he said, "Yeah, take care of your father while he's in India and meet me in 2 weeks in another place." And sure enough, a friend had a hit of acid. My father took it. He was a World War II pilot of a bomber for the RAF.
Wow.
And he thought, he had PTSD coming out of his ears. PTSD.
PTSD, yeah.
PTSD, oh my God. And anyhow, he had a death trip. And then Maharaji told a lot of stuff about his life that nobody could know. He fell on the floor. And from then on, we were fine. That's what it took.
Well, that just goes to show you how these other medicines can really help. I mean, absolutely. Obviously that's a whole nother world, but yeah. A wall, it can break through something powerful.
And that's why, I know you are helping a lot of people in many different ways, but certainly you understand, and we have never really talked about it, you and I, but the psychedelic therapy movement and what's going on with ceremonial gathering around these substances is very powerful. And you talked about people coming up to you, "Oh, yeah, just be here now. Yeah, I can't believe it," you know. And that's what happened 50 years ago.
Yeah.
The same thing. But you know what the same thing and that I get is, "Yeah, no, I had my first mushroom trip and I suddenly be here now appeared." I thought, what am I, in 1969 again? I mean, it's incredible the power of that particular statement and what Ram Dass said with that book in so many different ways, really all boiled down to be here now, which was an aphorism, by the way, that Ram Dass himself told me. No, this was me telling. I was traveling with Bhagwan Das, and he was taking me to see his guru, and I kept regaling him with stories of all my acid days with Leary and everything, and finally he got fed up and said, "Ram Dass, Richard," there was no
just
Ram Dass
here.
Yet. "Can you just be here now?" You know, he probably used an epithet as well. So it wasn't a holy
statement. You know?
But it all boils down to, you know, us being in that moment. Yeah.
Well, also, thank you so much for sharing that story about your father. Wow, what a powerful story that is. That's really,
All of that, by the way, is in Love Everyone, this wonderful book of our stories of going to India. And it's all detailed out, all kinds of fun stories about this. By the way, something else I forgot. Spring is joining us in August at a beautiful retreat center in the Blue Ridge Mountains, and we can't wait. And it's August 25th through 29th. Go to ramdass.org/mountain-retreat, and you'll see the whole lineup with Krishna Das and Bob Thurman and Sharon Salzberg will be zoomed in, unless we can kind of figure a way to drive her over.
Rally him there.
And East Forest will be there, and Nina Rao, and we got wonderful music, Shantala, Benji Wertheimer, and I will be there as well. And Duncan Trussell will zoom in as well, I believe. So, yeah, please go there, and you can you'll see the connecting links on that page. So
I'm very excited about that. Thank you for inviting me. I love the idea of being in the music. And
No, it's quite wonderful, you know, especially Krishnadas as it builds over each night of him doing all of that chanting. It's powerful. And then in the morning, same thing goes on with movement and chant. Yeah, it's really quite wonderful. Oh, boy. Okay, question. Another question. This is about karma. And when we talk about everything that we have been talking about in terms of compassion and strength and courage and all of these topics that Spring has brought up, yes, I would say karma is so present, but it cannot be. I'll give you my little thing. Spring will elaborate. It cannot. It is not a rational concept that we can say, oh, yeah, somebody just popped us in the head. Well, I'm going to pop them back. Karma, eh? You know, it's like what Ram Dass tells a great story that you're walking along the street. Somebody falls down and loses their drink, you know, by tripping. And you look down and go, karma. You know, that is the insanity of us in the West, the way that we think things are so rational and have no connectivity to that which is the mystery. So, it is so ever, it is such a deeply part of our whole system of as humans. And I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, so was the question, what is karma? Or?
Just is it already said, and how does it affect us, and how do we relate with understanding the things that happen in our lives that we either don't quite know how it came to that moment, or it actually is quite disturbing because we are looking back and going, oh my God, is this what I'm in store for?
Right. And I understand that, you know, we think about the bad things that have happened to us and we think, oh my gosh, was I this kind of person? Or I think, you know, it's interesting from the Buddhist perspective, I'll just add that piece in, is that, you know, actions can take a lot, lifetimes to have results, lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. Mm-hmm. And I like to look at karma as like I'm planting seeds all the time, right? With my body, speech, and mind, you know, I'm planting seeds. I'm a seed planter. I'm a gardener. What are you putting in the ground? And the great thing is karma is not static. It can be purified. What you do right now in this moment affects your past and your future simultaneously, you know, what you do in this moment. And we all carry a burden of our confused thoughts and our tangles. We all have to come in this life with our mesh of tangles, and it's our holy duty to nobly sort it out, right? We get our helping of all the madness. And you know, just know that every time that you're practicing and you're living a life that is ethical, that is, you're walking in integrity, you're walking in nobility, you're walking your path honestly, with compassion, that you're purifying karma. And there's things that you can actively do to offset karma. I want to, you know, the Dalai Lama, since we were talking about the Dalai Lama, you know, when I was younger, I did a lot of unskillful things, and they used to come up a lot on my meditation retreats. I remember I used to shoplift when I was 13 and all the, you know, just this is what happens when you don't have parents around, you know, when you're on your own, you it's not skillful. It's not good. The teenage mind left alone, not a good idea, you know? So I did a lot of things, and I can remember a time in my practice where I felt like, okay, I'm going to purify these things. And there's ways to purify that, you know, by developing regret, sincere regret, then actively confessing to someone. There's a power in confession, telling someone, I feel this is heavy on my heart. This, you know, just the act, monks and nuns confess once a month. They get together and have ceremonies where they confess things. Mm. It's just to unleash. It's like in 12 step. What do they say? You're only as sick as your secrets, right? So when we hold on to these things, they kind of take a life of their own of shame and blame. But when we get it out, we're like, oh, it feels lighter. Yeah. Okay. I did this thing. And then what you can do is you can also actively do good things and dedicate the merit to offset this other unskillful thing. Isn't that nice? You can do a good thing ledger. Over here. Yeah. Well, you know, they say it works. According to the Dalai Lama, I got this out of his book of How to Be Enlightened. Yeah, on a book about karma. He said you can do a good action. Maybe you give money to a temple, or you do something, or you help a group of monastics, or you do something. And then you say, may the goodness go with your whole heart to offset that unskillful action.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
You really can change
things. What's the name of that book?
There's a great book.
I ordered about 3 million of them. Do you remember the name?
It's called How to Be Enlightened by Dalai Lama.
Really?
And he talks about the whole practice, because I've memorized that section on karma because I teach that a lot. Because people often come to me, rather we're in Peru or we're here, and there's things that have happened. And they said, I wish I wouldn't have done that. I see it. You know, so it's a way we forgive ourselves too. You know, our karma is also what we have done and then what others have done, right? But the more we can start forgiving ourselves, the more we can forgive other people. It's so much easier when we look at our own mistakes and we say, okay, yeah. So karma is changeable. It's malleable. What you do right now affects the next moment. So it's kind of an alive state. You know, it means action. Actually, karma means action. So try not to get too hung up on who did what, when, why from the past. We just kind of have to work with the conditions, but more to pay attention to what am I doing now? How am I responding now? What is my energy now? Am I still hanging on to hatred? Am I being cruel? Am I being loving? Right? Because that's a seed in the ground. That plants a seed for the future. So just to be aware of that. Also, the other thing Dalai Lama said in his book is going on a pilgrimage also purifies karma. On these holy places, we can release energy, old past actions. Meditation purifies karma as we sit and we go through the fires and the sorrow and we just open, you know, when we do, we just open and let all the waves of energy go. We're purifying men. So we just accept, you know, things as they are, but we can offset things too. We can actively engage in forgiveness practice and then vow never to do it again. That was the last piece. Make a vow.
You know, when you said His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, if you do this, an offering with a pure heart.
Yes.
You know, as soon as you said that, I saw his face. It's just an image of, you know, I love him, you know, and I've seen him so many times live when he used to come here to teach. But in that moment, I just saw one great thing is you can, that's why it's, you know, you have on your little altar some of these beings. Mm-hmm. And this particular being, when you look at him, he is so full, His Holiness, full mm-hmm. of compassion and love. And you can be in that with him by virtue of just sitting quietly. Somebody just asked what's favorite practice, and you know, you'll say what's yours. But this occurs to me because I do have that. The image absolutely reflects who you are deep inside yourself. Maybe not so deep, but certainly, you know, most of us have that covered up. And the reflection of His Holiness in that moment, I just saw, how beautiful is that? Because he is an instant, he's a bridge to allow a pure heart to appear, you know? Mm-hmm. And he is certainly someone to have on one's altar. But that is a definitive practice, and whether it be one's guru, it doesn't have to be your guru, because there's only one guru, ultimately, that is that which has gone beyond and is no longer polarized and is not living in that kind of condition anymore. And to have them around as reflections allows that pure heart to manifest itself. Huh? So I think that's a good practice.
Yes, beautiful.
Okay, what's your favorite practice?
You know, I would say, honestly, at the end of the day, my favorite practice is always what we call the Brahma Viharas, the practices of developing compassion, kindness, joy, and equanimity, you know, and those are what I go to, but I also deeply love doing deep samadhi practice. Just doing kind of Vipassana, sitting, feeling my breath and going deeper and deeper and deeper, sort of jhana practice. That is pretty joyful when I get a chance to drop into that, to go that deep. I usually need a day or two to start cooking on that. But I do like to go to Goenka retreats and just drop in just for 10 days just to feel just myself just as vibration.
Is that how you first were exposed to Vipassana, through Goenka?
Not through Goenka. Actually, my first exposure was from going on a retreat, an Insight Tradition. I was 24 and doing a 10-day retreat that was Mahasi Sayadaw. And it just so happened on that retreat, Jack Kornfield was leading it. I had no idea who was leading the retreat. I just heard about this retreat in Yucca Valley in the desert where they'll teach you how to meditate, as I was looking to learn because I was practicing on my own and wasn't going very well. I was trying to be a self-taught using Paramahansa Yogananda's school. First, I was Hindu. And then I was like, wait, I need someone to help me. I'm not getting very far. So I ended up there. And so and that's really where I started practicing Vipassana.
So it's, I don't even know if you know this, but most of us, a large percentage of the Westerners that went to India to be with Neem Karoli, through Ram Dass and other, mostly through Ram Dass, to be with Neem Karoli Baba, not through his prompting, ended up at the Goenka course.
Goenka Ji, yeah. Yes. You know,
that's where we met Joseph and Sharon, and then later Jack. And but he knew about it because it became a place. Oh, good. Let me get rid of these people. You're going to the course? He'd say in English, course, get.
Yes,
and
going.
And we all got that grounding, most of us, in insight meditation, Vipassana. So I, whenever I get a chance to recommend that, and we have our closest people with Jack and now Spring is, you know, joining us to help us spread that message, but Joseph and Sharon, and you can go to any of them and really get a wonderful grounding, and particularly around, because we're talking about compassion. So one of the practices that they brought back is metta, loving kindness practice. And I know you are familiar, so this would be a kind of a good way to close out our session around loving kindness.
Yes, how beautiful. And also Goenka, you know, what a beautiful spirit. I mean, just like really was trying to reduce suffering.
Oh, what he's done for us
worldwide. You know, going to centers in Ecuador and Mexico, and
it's amazing.
And he's also our ancestor, and so alive in those courses. You know, he's just right there. So the loving kindness practice, yes, it's beautiful. To at the end of the day, to sit with yourself and wish yourself well. And wish others well. And to think of that as a real holy practice is so powerful. Mm. You know, again, we have to train in these qualities of the heart. We have to train in compassion, train in loving kindness, train in equanimity, you know, and even training in joy, because we can get caught up in the troubles of the world and forget joy and gratitude. But Ram Dass really remembered that joy. He kind of emanated that, that cosmic joy in the face of all kinds of difficulties, you know? And we can follow our ancestor in that. We can follow. I got so excited, I pulled my headphones out. We can follow these ancestors of ours, our enlightened ancestors. Follow them. They're there. They're alive.
Just one last question, and it relates to what you were just offering, and it's around joy and how all of this is always perspective. How to move over just a little bit to the left or right. And so this person is talking about, I walk around with the glass half empty, which many of us do. So moving that perspective over just enough so that joy can creep in and upend this half empty glass.
Right. Well, you have to look at everything every day, write down in the morning, five things that you're grateful for. Even if it's for your pillow, you have a
totally
pillow.
I'm grateful for my pillow.
Exactly. Imagine. Some people have this. I'm grateful that I have water. I can drink the water. I'm grateful have, you know, it's like you start to think of like what you, instead of what you don't have, what you do have. That's why gratitude practice is so important. It's the step towards joy. It's like walk out, go, I have shoes. Oh my God, I have shoes. I can walk up, walk outside. And if you can see the sun, I can see the sun. You know, it starts simple because there's really no magic pill here, right? It's like the antidote to the half empty pessimistic glass is always gratitude, because unless we recognize the gifts that we are given, we'll never feel happy. And appreciate the beauty that's in our lives. There's always some beauty in someone's life. And that's honestly why I really enjoyed spending so much time in Peru. The Peruvians that I was around a lot in the jungles, they had very little, but they had this joy that was like, yeah, we're poor, but we're happy, you know, and this idea of sharing and family. And of course, they wanted things. They wanted technology at times or other things, but it was this kind of just, it's something about Latin America that is like, there's this warmth of heart that's like, gratitude for what we have, you know, pray on your food. Don't just eat it like, wow, I have some bread. Wow, I have eggs. Wow, I can make a sandwich or breakfast or oatmeal or salad. You know, it's to, you have to open the eyes of the sacred, you know, and that's not easy. That's not easy, but it can be done. But just start with five things every day. Wake up for the person who sees things as half empty and so sad to see emptiness in your life. Not in the wise emptiness, but in the kind of, you know,
nihilistic,
nihilistic, depressed emptiness. So go for five things. Sit down. Look around. Your cat. Okay, great. Anything that you can appreciate. Start appreciating it.
Yes. Thank you so much, Spring.
Yes. Thank you. I know it is great to hang out. What a gift that's happened. We had our lovely other hostess needs to take a break, and Jacqueline, and now you're here. So we get to hang out.
See, I got
blessings for that.
Yeah.
Yes.
really. Glad that I was able to be here, that we were able to do this and share this with people. And it will be, by the way, you will be able to check it out because it is being recorded. And you go to ramdas.org/livestream-replays. So you can do that. And I'm going to say again, please go to ramdas.org/mountain-retreat and check out where Spring is going to join us with Krishna Das, Sharon Salzberg, Robert Thurman, Nina Rao, and East Forest. And that's August 25th. And please take a look at that. We'd love to have satsang with you, with everybody. And guess who's here next month when we do this, Spring? Sharon. Sharon Salzberg's going to join
us. Sharon's everywhere. I love it. She gets around. I love it. Our dear Sharon.
Yeah, really, really. And, you know, whatever help you can do, by the way, to help support Love Server Member Foundation, all these offerings, which are free, and we just exist because you're part of the community and the part that helps us that way. And just like there's people like Gina and JR are helping make this happen right now. It's all part of one fabric. So you can text satsang to 91999. 91999. Or Gina, you're supposed to put the chat in the chat link, the link, because you can go direct to just do it online. So thank you for that. Thank you for being here. And we'll see you next time. I'm probably forgetting something, Jackie. If you're watching this, I'm so sorry. I'm not as good as
you. It's all perfect. It's all there.
Thank you, everyone. We will see you next
time. Bye, everyone.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.